hit that. So welcome back to Humber Justice Podcast. And today, this morning, it's just going to be me, Doug Thompson, doing it. Steve is stuck in snow in Barrie, up to his eyeballs probably. And today we have Superintendent, I have to edit that out, Deborah Preston from the Toronto Police Service. And Deb, could you just describe what you do? What is your job in the TPS?
First of all, good morning and thank you for having me here. My position is I'm the disciplinary hearings officer. I'm a superintendent. And in that role, I deal with all serious police misconduct that have been elevated to the tribunal level for a decision.
So do you run the tribunal?
I'm in charge of the tribunal. If you look at it in terms of, say, an adjudicator, where they have counsel who will come with the subject officer, and they'll have a prosecutor on the other side, and then I am the adjudicator in the middle who, at the end of the day, has to make a decision around whatever the case is in front of me.
So how does someone end up in front of you? What have they done?
Well, there could be a variety of things. We have in our discipline process, discipline could be handled at the unit level, depending on what it is, and or it could be investigated by professional standards and sent back to the divisional level. Or they could think, you know what, this is serious enough that we need a tribunal decision. We need a larger decision on this in the interest of public interest. It could also come to us by virtue of the Office of the Independent Police Review Director, who orders a hearing. Or it could be a decision that we've already rendered and has gone to the Commission for appeal, and they've ordered another hearing on the same issue.
So this is, you deal with violations of the Police Service Act?
That's correct.
Okay. So what is the police, why does the police have this internal Police Service Act?
Well, the Police Services Act is for the entire province of Ontario. And a lot of people look and say, and have the belief that it deals primarily with police discipline. But it's a much broader act than police discipline. It's divided up into, and you're testing my memory here, but it's probably about six or seven sections to it. And it's everything from, you know, responsibility for police services around like shared services, amalgamation, what the duties of the chief are, what the duties of the board are. And then there's this one piece in the Police Services Act, which is called Part 5. And that deals directly with police discipline in all police services and the Ontario Police, Ontario Provincial Police in Ontario. So it's not just specific to police discipline. And in our world, we deal specifically with Part 5 and one of another section, which is called the Statutory Powers and Procedures Act, which speaks directly to what goes on in police tribunals.
Okay. So the police services hire a lot of civilians.
Yes.
And do they fall under this as well?
No. The Police Services Act is specific to uniformed police officers.
Okay. So could you provide an example of the process for if an officer breaks a rule or procedure? So they break part of the Police Services Act.
Mm-hmm.
What happens next? How do they get from that point to suddenly appearing in front of you? And what's the sort of timeline on that?
Well, usually it happens where somebody identifies that there has been what they believe to be misconduct. So an investigation takes place and it's either founded or it's unfounded. If it's unfounded, then that's the end of it. If they substantiate that there is police misconduct, then the unit commander will have a look at it and decide whether or not it falls into what we call unit level discipline, where he or she can handle the discipline at their own level, at their own unit. Sometimes they've elevated it to professional standards, and they'll do the investigation, and it'll either, again, go back to the unit level, or they'll decide to elevate it to the disciplinary hearings office. And once it goes to the disciplinary hearings office, it goes to a prosecutor. So there's a lot of steps that people of review, that people have to have a look at it. So the prosecutor will have a look at it and see if it's something that is serious enough that warrants a disciplinary tribunal, or through discussions, is it something that still can be handled at the unit level?
So what would the difference in the offence be between handled at the unit level and being pushed higher up?
Well, it's more like minor offences, mistakes. There's a lot of difference between, in my mind, I differentiate between people make mistakes, and they do in any profession, they do in ordinary life. People do things that are wrong, but are they serious? Are they something that have a huge impact on the public interest? Or is it something that we can say, you know what, you've made a mistake and let's handle it and let's teach you and correct you and go on and you're going to be a well-producing officer in the future? Or is it something that is serious enough that it has to go further and it has to come before me? And there could be like criminal offenses, or if somebody is charged with a criminal offense, it's automatic that it goes to the tribunal. If it has a significant impact, as I've mentioned before, on the public interest, or the public would have a significant interest in
the offense. But how is that determined in terms of, does it impact public interest?
It's usually determined between either the unit commander will say, here is an issue that I have that I believe needs to go higher. But generally, it's who's ever in charge of professional standards will make that call. Does it go back to the unit level, or does it go to the disciplinary office?
Could you give an example of what that would be, what kind of offence that would be?
Well, again, a criminal offence is certainly something that goes right to a tribunal. There's no discussion around it. Anything that deals with the CPIC system, the Canadian Police Information Centre, that's where we store all of our confidential information around vehicles or people. If there's any violation of that, it goes right to the tribunal.
So someone's used the system for their own ends.
Right.
Okay.
So that would go right to the tribunal. But if it's something like I'm late for duty, I've misplaced my memo book, those are lesser issues that could be handled at the unit level and do not need to come to the tribunal.
So if a police officer breaks the law, is there a difference if they are on duty or off duty?
No. As long as there is a section in the Police Services Act where as long as there's a nexus to the job, and I'll use impaired driving as an example. If you're off duty and you have been convicted for impaired driving, we look and say, what is the impact to policing? Well, you've got a one-year driving prohibition. That has a direct impact on your ability to be able to do your job for that 1 year. So there's a direct impact to your job. So as long as there's a nexus back to your position as a police officer, you automatically go to the tribunal.
And what would be the punishment for drink, if you're caught drink driving, what would you do? What would happen to them in the tribunal?
Well, the evidence is presented before me, and it's really case specific. Because it may start off at, right now we're at about 20 days to demotion, appears to be about the average case, but it could be a case of repeated offenses around impaired driving. It could be repeated offenses where somebody has an alcoholic issue behind them where accommodation may come into play. So everything is very case specific, but it's really the offense itself, does it warrant to go back this way, or does it have to be elevated? And then when it comes to me, I have to look at a wide variety of issues, such as what have we done before? Consistency of discipline is significant in our world. Public interest is significant in our world. And then make a determination. We have 16 sentencing principles, and I'd love to say what they are right off the top of my head, but I can't.
we can do a link to those.
We look at things such as the type of discipline, the seriousness of the discipline, the recognition of the seriousness of the discipline, what their employment record to date has been like, negative and positive entries. And we look at accommodation issues, impact on the officer and their family, and at the end, consistency, again, being, through other case law.
I teach law, and I'm teaching the charter at the moment, and one of the things here, seems to me, is if a person, let's stick with the drink driving, so if a person goes to court and gets convicted of drink driving, aren't you retrying them for the same offence?
No, and that's a common question, and I appreciate that question, because when you go to court, you're proving it at a certain level, and it's definitely beyond a reasonable doubt. When you come into a police tribunal level, we're a civil tribunal. So we base our convictions on a balance of probabilities, but we use different factors, different sentencing principles, as I've mentioned, some I've alluded to be able to reach that level. So we're not retrying it, because we're not looking at it through the lens of a criminal court, and we're not looking at it through the lens of beyond a reasonable doubt. We are an employee-employer tribunal. So we're looking at it as far as an individual's ability to be able to do their job. We're not looking at it through the criminal lens.
So your is much more labor law?
It's very much labor law. Okay. And
so the principles that you follow is much more like civil court than criminal court?
It's very much civil court. We are a civil proceeding at the end of the day, and we are an employer-employee relationship-based tribunal.
So you said that one of the key things is public interest. Are the results of the courts made public?
They are. We work on the open court principle, so anybody is welcome to attend a tribunal unless it's something that, as the hearing officer, I decide has to be in camera, which means it's not accessible to the public, and there's usually a variety of reasons for that. But it's an open court principle, means anybody can attend and they can listen to the proceedings as they come out. The decisions are made public afterwards within our service. You can contact our corporate communications office to receive a copy of a decision, and we don't shy away from providing those.
Do you think that's important to make the process open?
Absolutely, because we're not looking to hide behind any kind of a shield or any kind of protection. It's important that the public knows we are holding our members accountable, and it's important for members also to know that they are going to be held accountable, because deterrent is one of the key sentencing principles as well, should they be found guilty. But also, if somebody is not found guilty, to be able to articulate why, because there is a public interest and there's an interest on behalf of the members as to why that person was not found guilty.
Could you provide examples of the most common offences that are committed by police officers or civilian members?
Well, civilian members I'm not involved in, so I can't really speak to that piece of it. When it comes to commonalities, it's a difficult question, because there's such a range of issues that come before us. Impaired driving is one that we have struggled with, and I would believe that every police service has struggled with that. The reason behind it, I don't know. But I can say that within our own service, that the number of people charged with impaired driving reduced substantially last year. And I don't know the reason for that either. I wish I had that magic reason. But when I say, common themes, we have an average of about 6 per year. To me, that's 6 too many. And especially since we hold the public accountable for these offenses, and we shouldn't be committing the very same offenses. But last year, and I don't have the number before me, but I know that it went down dramatically. And I'm hoping that's a trend that we're going to see through 2016.
I know that a lot of the common punishments in criminal court for drink driving is that you must have a breathalyzer fitted to your car. Doesn't that impose an undue burden on them? I mean, what do you do with a police officer who's meant to be driving a car? You can't put a breathalyzer on every single car.
Right. And that's one of the reasons, in addition to the fact that it's a criminal offense, but one of the reasons why it does come to us. And if it is a first offense, we're a large organization, and that's one of the things under, the Human Rights Code and accommodation that we have to look at is, although that they do have this restriction on them, is there a place within the organization where they can be placed and they have a position that is regular work, that is of value, and we're not just creating jobs for them. And we do have those types of positions where they can do their work from for that year, and or they can go out and they can walk a beat and for that 1 year period, or whatever period that they're assessed that breathalyzer requirement.
Does rank matter?
No, rank does not matter. I can hear up to and including one rank below where I am right now. Anything above that, they would have to have a higher ranking officer as an adjudicator.
Okay. So is the process stepped? So... Those are Steve's questions.
Would you notice that that's circled on mine?
Yeah, we'll have to edit this bit out. Basically, is if you've committed multiple offences, does the punishment get harsher and harsher and harsher?
Yes, it is. It is stepped. We refer to it as progressive discipline. And so, if this is not your first appearance in the tribunal, then we have to look at what was the punishment, and we don't refer to it as punishment; it's a penalty. What is the penalty that you've received last time? And so your penalty that you will receive for your current offense will be higher. But sometimes there are those cases that come before us that stand alone, that it may be their first time in the tribunal that is egregious enough that it warrants a significant penalty. Or they could come and, you know, case law dictates that it should be, you know, a shorter penalty, but again, it's serious enough that a larger penalty is substantiated.
What is the largest penalty you can give?
Dismissal.
And how difficult is it to dismiss a police officer?
It is difficult because the Ontario Civilian Police Commission has laid down that the test is usefulness to the police service and to the community. So for us to move forward with dismissal, we have to show that they've outlived their usefulness to the organization. And that is a very high threshold, and it's a high threshold for a number of reasons, because, you know, you've come onto a profession and you've sworn an oath of office, and we get to the point where we're now saying that you're no longer useful or you've outlived your usefulness and we're going to fire you. So it has to be a high level for that specific reason.
Right.
And we don't end up dismissing a lot of officers in the tribunal, but it's definitely has been done, and it has been done historically.
What do you have to do to get fired?
Oh, that's a loaded question. Thank you, Doug. There's what I will say for that is, you know, there really is no one size fits all. It's when I still go back and say it's case specific. Any case where an officer is dismissed at the tribunal level is pretty well automatically appealed to the Ontario Civilian Police Commission by the Toronto Police Association. And that's their prerogative, and I support them on that, because if they find that I have made the wrong decision, or they have trouble with the decision or how I've articulated it, then it's best to have a second set of eyes to have a look at it for a number of reasons. And again, it goes back to making sure that the public's interest is looked after, as well as the officer's interest is looked after. So it really is sort of that two-step process. I don't shy away from, you know, something going to be appealed, or for the commission to come back and say, you know what, we don't agree with you.
Right.
And that's fine, because oversight should be a significant part of this process.
So with the accused officer, are they given legal representation?
Yes, they're afforded legal representation, which is provided by the association or the senior officer organization, and they stand with them as counsel. We have a senior officer, an inspector, who acts as a prosecutor, and for the most part, a superintendent who acts as the adjudicator. So you do have, you're up against a lawyer, and they provide varieties of arguments on behalf of their clients. And it's up to us to be able to take all of the material that we're provided at the end of the day, which is voluminous, and go back and read it. And I read every word on every page. And just to make sure, if I'm going to make a decision around somebody, I want to make sure that it's the most informed decision, and that it's going to withstand scrutiny, and that it's also best for all the parties concerned.
In your opinion, with the people that you've seen, How many years have you been doing this?
I've been doing this for 2 years.
Right. Who's most likely to commit an infraction? Is it the new recruit, 5-year veteran, or the more experienced officer?
You know, I would say that there is no one size fits all. There is no pattern that I see that shows, you know, years of experience or, you know, personal age or whatever the case may be that come before me. It could be somebody that is more senior in years, or somebody that's brand new on the job, or somebody, you know, two people that come before me with the same offense that are tied together with an offense. One is very senior, one is very junior. So there is no one size fits all with this. It's you do see that it runs the gamut.
One of the big arguments in academic work on policing is the whole idea of the rotten barrel versus the rotten apple. So is it the structure or the individual that causes police officer misconduct? Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Well, again, another great question, Doug. I look and say that I can only speak on behalf of our organization, but we have all of the structure in place to support officers and give them the proper direction on, you know, what they can do, what they can't do. The policies are in place to be able to both instruct and direct and support them. And we have the proper supervisory pieces in place to be able to support them and direct them. So at that point, then it's up to the officer to be able to, you know, go forth and do their job the way that they said they would do when they joined the organization and they swore to their oath of office that they would do certain things.
Right.
People, and I always say this to new recruits because I do speak to new recruits, when they come on the organization, we hire them because they have a quality of character that we're looking for, that they're going to represent us well. And we've recognized something in them, and we're making a tremendous investment in that individual. And I always say to them, you know what, don't change. You've come on with that character or that quality that we're looking for, and we don't want you to change. There's no need to change, and I would put it out to whether it's a police service, a Humber College, any organization, you don't have to change to be accepted. You don't have to change to fit in. I look back over, I've been here 29 years. I mean, I don't think I have changed much. You'd have to go back and ask other people if that's the case, but I don't think my personality has changed in 29 years. It's pretty steady, and people know what I'm like or how I'm going to react or where I'm going to come from. So when people come on, that's what we expect of them through their 30-year career. Sometimes we have people that come on that, you know, try to... They'll watch television and try to, you know, replicate what they see on television.
Yeah.
And that's not who we are as an organization. So that's not going to bode you well in the future. So to say, you know, is it the rotten apple or the rotten barrel, all the checks and balances are in place to make every individual come on successful. They know the rules. So I don't want to necessarily say it's the rotten apple as well, because somewhere along the line, something's happened or they've fallen off the barrel, so to speak. But it's also never too late to be able to say, look, I've made a mistake, or I need help, or show me the way, what have I done wrong? And that's what we encourage officers to do. So it's sort of a two-sided coin. It's very much an individual decision when you go and you do something, but you have to know that all the supports are in place to help you along the
right.
way and help you make those decisions.
So here at Humber, as you well know, we teach police foundations and the degree in criminal justice. And a lot of our students are planning and have gone into policing. What can we do as professors to teach, what can we teach students so that they don't end up in front of you? Or what skills do you think they need or they need to build up while they're here at Humber?
Sometimes it's not so much the hard skills, it's more the soft skills. And I still go back to say a lot of it is the decision-making skills or having a personal decision-making matrix that they themselves can follow. And they're not going to sway from that. And the ability to be able to have the strength of character to stand up and say, you know, this is wrong. Or if somebody is doing something and they know that it's wrong at its very core, to be able to find a supervisor, find a coach officer, find a friend and say, I know that this is going on and it's wrong. That's hard to do. That takes a lot of character for somebody to do. And I admire people that are able to do it. It's not ratting somebody out, because that individual represents 5,000 other officers, you know, 3,000 civilian members, and they represent me. And at the end of the day, I would rather, and I have in my career, I have stood up and I've had to testify against another officer in court, probably one of the most uncomfortable times of my career. But I look back and say it was the absolute right thing to do. And I don't, you know, I wouldn't look back and I wouldn't say, you know, I wish I hadn't done that.
Right.
But for people just to really know who they are at their very core and what they're willing to accept and not accept. Because it's more than one thing to come onto a job and say, you know, I'll take the oath of office, or I want to be a police officer because I'm going to make a, I want to make a difference. That's what we hear, I'd say, 99% of the time. But now it's time to go out and make that difference, because you've been given that responsibility to do that. There's certain things that we can teach, and there's certain things that we can't teach. But one of the things that we can share is, if you've got the right personality, the right characteristics, the right qualities, the right ethics, then don't change those things when you come onto a profession. You're going to see some things that are absolutely wonderful and joyous in this organization. And there's, in my entire career, I can say that there's not one day that I've not wanted to come into work. After, you know, 29 years, I still can't believe I get paid to do this job. Just please don't tell the chief, because I need my paycheck. But I absolutely love what I do. And I haven't changed in that time period. And I wish everybody, and I've seen some things, you know, through the job itself that have been very, you know, ugly, not in terms of police discipline or things that officers have done, but perhaps calls for service that you get involved in that are not pleasant. And it's a matter of what do you have in place as support systems for yourself and through the service that, you know, we can take part of, that we can take advantage of, that is going to help us through those rough times that we find ourselves. And if there's anything to be able to reinforce at Humber College, it's those types of messages. How you get them across, I'm not sure, but a lot of it is just stay true to yourself.
Right. So in your 29 years in the police service, have you seen a shift in police culture in terms of what is unacceptable or acceptable behavior?
I haven't really seen a shift in, well, please edit that. I have seen a shift in what is acceptable and not, because one of the main things that we look at in the tribunal in any decision writing is specific and general deterrence. So when we're writing a decision, we're writing to the officer, we're writing to the public complainant. This is all in the same decision. So we're writing to the public complainant so he or she has a full understanding of what's going on. We're also writing to the police commission so they understand how we have formulated our decision. But what I have found as far as a shift in police culture is I do believe that people are following the rules. Sometimes people, again, make mistakes, and people do things that are just purely unacceptable, and criminal behavior is unacceptable. But at the end of the day, I totally forgot what I was going to say. the shift in police culture.
Yeah. So it's like when you came on as a recruit, were you treated, or did you see people being treated in a way then that was acceptable, that now would be like, there's no way you'd do it?
No, I would honestly say no, because what was unacceptable then is still unacceptable now. And I don't think there are officers out there that are doing things any more different than they did 29 years ago, but I think there's a greater degree of transparency around the discipline process right now, where we do operate, again, on the open court principle, where people are allowed to sit and listen. We have media that attend and report on what's going on. They do workshops around, or not workshops, but they do exposés, I suppose, in the newspaper around various cases. So there's a greater degree of transparency. And with that transparency comes a greater degree of discussion. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
So I'm all for having those discussions and being engaged in those discussions. I just have to watch the type of discussions I have and with whom. It's a very lonely job, I'll have to say that. I am a party of one, and I don't involve myself in gossip. I don't answer to, you know, the various police organizations or associations, and I report directly to the chief. So I don't engage in discussions around cases. I don't listen to anything that pertains to various cases that are live, and I don't take instruction from anybody in terms of what the decision is supposed to be. So at the end of the day, I'm the lone person sitting there writing the decision, knowing that there's going to be there's a greater degree of transparency and there's a greater degree of oversight, and I welcome both of those things.
So the thing I just thought about that was interesting is that you seem to operate in a very independent role in the police force. Now, in the United States, a lot of the police forces there, all their discipline is internal. So it's not a separate unit.
Right.
Why do you think we have a different system to the United States?
Well, I think it's, I don't know the reason why, but I can just say that I think it's most important here, so I'm not influenced. I don't need to have any external influences around decisions, or I don't need to have somebody else's opinion. Everything, if somebody's going to speak to me about a case, first of all, I stop them. And the PSA, specifically the Statutory Powers and Procedures Act, dictates that all parties have to be present. So I do work very independently. So if I'm going to have any kind of a discussion, the prosecutor, the subject officer, the public complainant, if need be, and the defense counsel must be present. If I have sought out any legal advice, then I have to bring it back to all the parties to say, here's the advice that I've received, and now let's discuss it. So it is a very independent position, so I do not have that outside influence, because there could be, you know, a variety of actors or a variety of players that want to see different things. And at the end of the day, it's my decision based on the information that I'm given in the hearing office, as well as the materials that I take away with me and that I read. So I can't say is it a better process or a worse process, but I can certainly say that it is independent and it's fair.
Great. What advice would you give our students who want to go into a career in policing?
Go for it. This, as I mentioned, is, you know, I came to Toronto to be a teacher, and I wanted to, that was going to be my forever job, as I call it, and I fell into policing accidentally. I started as a dispatcher because I needed a job, and after I finished, when I thought that was over and I got that phone call for, okay, we're going to hire you as a teacher, I was going to go and do that as my profession. But the more that I got involved in as a dispatcher, I loved it. And I just wanted to know what was on the other end of that phone call. Every time I received a 911 call or I was dispatching and the officers were out at, a large call, as I would say, I wanted to know what was going on at that scene. I wanted to be there, like I wanted to feel it. So I just decided, you know, I'm going to apply and see what happens. And I don't think anybody was more surprised than I was when I received that letter in the mail saying, you have been hired. And I was never, you know, so thrilled, so excited, so scared, so nervous, because I had no idea what to expect. I had no idea what to expect through training. And it has been the most fulfilling career that I could ever have imagined. I've had 17 different jobs in one career. What other organization could you walk into and experience that same thing? So I've worked for the same organization in 17 different capacities, and every one of them, you know, has superseded the one before it, where I just thought, you know, this has been the best position that I've ever had in the organization. Then I'll go on to the next one, and I'll think, man, this is the best thing I've ever experienced. And then it just keeps going up. And those are the opportunities I've been given, because I look back and say, I've worked hard. I've gone on to higher learning. Education to me is the key to opening up a lot of doors. And if you're not ready right now for a career in policing, then extend your education, because that is going to open up doors, whether it's in policing or anywhere else. It certainly has for me. Plus having mentors, you know, having, I know there's a new name for it now. I don't know if it's the coaches or mentors or leaders, right. But having those people within whatever profession you have that help guide the way. They don't open the doors for you. You have to do that yourself. But they help you develop yourself at that level, so you're able to march through that door with confidence and take on these extra responsibilities. This is the best job in the world. I would not give it up. I love it. And I don't know if that passion comes through, but if people are interested in this job, then again, I go back to go for it. Because what you bring to the table is what you're going to get out of it. So the more you bring, the more, not the better your career is going to be, but the more fulsome your career is going to be, and the more opportunities that you're going to be able to have.
Great. That's fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very, very much, Deb. That was incredibly informative. And I'm sure you'll be back again.
I look forward to it.